Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We have positively merged the streams from 23 years of sports radio. Now, with almost 2 years of Baltimore Positive, we had a great visit with Dutch Rupersberger, who was our very first guest at Pete's John's almost a year and a half ago now. And we now have more sponsors than ever. Big thanks to our friends at Taharka. I ate all the peanut butter cup in here, but you can get your own and serve up social change made here in Baltimore with love. And the pink truck can come out and serve you up a scoop of some ice cream as well as the weather changes. And we're chatting with friends from Taharka and the folks that make the ice cream here at Baltimore Positive. You can find that out at Food and Drink. Speaking of food and drink, over at Catonsville, Don Moeller and I waiting for the opening of El Guapo so I can get some quesadillas. And, of course, we can be across the street at State Fair getting some chicken and waffles and some shrimp and grits. Hope to get back there. This is the kind of podcast we would be having over there if we weren't so socially distanced. Or we would take Steny Hoyer down to Fadley's and get some crab cakes and some oysters on the half and fry up some fish and maybe have a little bit of a chowder as well. You can still get those crab cakes delivered to you one click away all around us here at Baltimore Positive. Don, you set this one up. It is you knew we were kicking the website off this week, right? Like, you knew we had big things going on. You're like, I'm going to muscle up, throw my weight around as a former county executive, and I'm going to get some guests here this week, right?
Why not get the majority leader of the United States Senate, the esteemed congressman, Steny Hoyer. Steny, welcome to Baltimore Positive. We're delighted to have you.
Don, I don't want to get our viewers confused. I'm the majority leader of the House of Representatives.
Oh, what did I say? The Senate? There you go.
The Senate.
He was wishful thinking. He's thinking ahead is what he's doing. Forward thinking.
You know why?
I don't want to make Cardin, who's my buddy, nervous, nor Chris Van Hollen. House.
You know why I said, because I have in my notes, and I knew this in the past.
Right.
You were elected in 1966 and quickly became the youngest Senate president in the history of the Maryland legislature. I don't know how someone gets elected in 1966 as a young kid from Southern Maryland and then becomes president of the Senate. So I had president of the Senate.
Now, he was calling you senator back in the 70s, right?
Absolutely.
It's understandable, Don. You know what I tell people? When they introduce me and say I was the youngest president in the history of the Maryland Senate, I say that's the good news. The bad news is it was so long ago.
But you're still making a difference. Listen, before we get into everything, and good Lord knows there's a lot going on, I've got to tell you, you probably can't see this, Nestor. It's hard to see. I'm going to hold it up. I've got a little sheet of paper that I carry. It's all wrinkled and crunched. It's so wrinkled, I had to take a picture of it so that it wouldn't get destroyed. It's a little piece of paper that Congressman Hoyer gave me a couple years ago when we were together at a gathering. And Steny, you'll remember it. It says, you make America better with Democrats. I always call this the Hoyer chart. And it really talks about the myth. And it's so funny. And I really want to kick it off with this, because I have a lot of friends and relatives who still buy the myth that the economy thrives under Republican leadership. And that's why this thing is so crumpled up. I always go into my wallet and I say, well, let me show you this chart that Congressman Hoyer shared with me. Talk a little bit, Steny, about that chart and why America traditionally has fared better under Democratic leadership.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because I love that chart. I don't have one in front of me right now, but I love that chart. And essentially, what we did was we took a 68-year snapshot of what happened during those 68 years. And the interesting thing is Democrats had 24 years, no, 20 of those, 28 of those years, and 26 of those years, and Republicans had 32. So it was uneven. And it was, you had a Republican, then you had a Democrat, then you had a Republican. So it wasn't like it was just one stretch of time. And that's why I think it's so compelling. And essentially what it shows, every Democratic administration did better than every Republican administration in terms of the jobs created, in terms of the stock market created, And the even better news than that, in terms of this class warfare that our Republican friends sometimes accuse us of, every quintile, that meant the bottom 20% and the top 20% and the 60% in between, all did better under Democrats. That's not true of Republican presidents. Some, most of them did better. Some had all. But Democrats, in every case, had all quintiles doing better under there. And I think it is because we invest in the people. We invest in education. We invest in growth. And we also give a sense of stability in the economy. So that's badly needed today, Don. And that's what Joe Biden is going to return to the country. A sense of stability, a sense of common sense and rationality, a sense of steady as she goes, as opposed to one tweet today and the opposite tweet tomorrow, and then a third tweet the day after, where you never know where we are. So, but thank you for bringing up that chart, because it's a very compelling chart when you know, our Republican friends talk about, oh, well, we're good for the economy. We're good for the economy.
Don, you're muted right now. Steny Hoyer joining us right now. I need to ask you, through all of these years, when you talk about now, and for someone young, for someone that's 20 years old, 25 years old, they may say that the government's never really worked well in their lifetime, or they believe that at any point, or they would have checked the box that said, is the government running well? They probably would say, no, I don't want to date you, but you're a few years older than me. I was born in 68. But
I was elected to the state senate in 66.
I know. This is why I know you have wisdom. This is why I come to you looking for wisdom, wise wisdom. Give me an example of when it was running well and why it was running well, and how. Give me some hope that it can run well again. Because look, I have all these people from Pennsylvania that come on. I hold my ballot. I'm like, vote, vote, vote. I'm telling everybody to vote. It's all month long.
God bless you.
Yeah, but at some point, we have to believe that it can be work again. Right? Like Washington can work again for all of us.
All right.
Go ahead.
Nestor, let me answer that question. First of all, the government worked well under Bill Clinton. And frankly, it worked pretty well under Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was willing to make compromises. And I think, frankly, he ran up the debt as a percentage more than any Democratic president has driven. But that aside, Ronald Reagan had common sense and a willingness to work with others and to compromise, which is so absent in this administration. But let me tell you, in the Clinton administration, it worked. And as a result, Bill Clinton won two terms. As a result, we picked up House seats. We didn't take the majority. But the only time in your lifetime that we've had four surpluses, budget surpluses in a row, was under Bill Clinton. His last term from fiscal year 98, 99, 2000, 2001, which was his last fiscal year. We had balanced budgets. The economy grew. The stock market grew 246%, 226%. All numbers better than Donald Trump has had. And then the Obama administration worked. Think for a second. What was the scandal in the Obama administration?
Zero.
What? Zero.
Zero.
Nobody indicted. Nobody convicted. Nobody pled guilty. Trump's got person after person after person who pled guilty. And some found guilty. Of course, he pardoned or commuted the sentence of Stone. But under Obama, no scandal. He took an economy that was in the dumpster. And by investing and working with the Congress, brought that economy back to a growing economy. And, you know, Trump and Pence beat their chests about how they helped the economy. If you look at the line from about 2010, which was the second year that Obama was president, up to 2017, you see almost a straight line up in terms of growth, employment, deficit coming down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you go to January 2017, that line keeps going, and it keeps going, and it's almost a straight line up. In other words, the economy that Obama got going, and the economy that Trump inherited has simply increased at the same rate it was increasing under Barack Obama. Unlike Barack Obama, Trump inherited a growing economy. Obama took a economy that was in the dumpster in a recession and took us up. So from that standpoint, I think we have a very strong argument that that's what Democrats do, and that's what Don was talking about in terms of that graph that I gave him of 68 years of experience, Republicans and Democrats. So I think we have a good argument to make, and I think Joe Biden is talking about investment. He's talking about building back better, which is Don, I talked to him about my Make It in America. And as a matter of fact, he included Make It in America in the Democratic platform this year. So
Don's holding it up. There it is.
That's the Make It in America. Under Democrats, you make it in America. And if you look honestly at the performance, where did we have the recessions? Why did Bill Clinton win? It's the economy, stupid. And the economy was not thriving under George H.W. Bush. It thrived under Bill Clinton. Al Gore lost the election. He got more votes than George Bush. But the economy, the deepest recession that you've experienced, that I've experienced, that Don has experienced, occurred under George Bush in December of 2007 and kept going through 2009 when we brought it out of the recession into growth, into job creation, and frankly, bringing down the deficit. So I think we have a very good argument to make, but we need to keep doing it. And Joe Biden has made growing the economy, investing in infrastructure, investing in education, investing in the things that people need will grow the economy, investing in a clean environment and climate change response. I think Joe Biden's going to win this election, and I think we're going to see the economy grow and flourish under Joe Biden.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, Congressman, that now even the rating houses are beginning to weigh in. And yep. You see Moody's and the others saying, look, we're likely to have a much more significant growth under the Biden plan than we would under President Trump. But it's impossible, Congressman. And I always hate to dwell on what I call the crazy. But as I walked in here today to sit down to do this podcast, there's a blur, a crawl coming across my TV that says in his latest tweet, the president calls on William Barr to indict President Barack Obama and Vice President Biden for some made up fantasy that he has about the past and their involvement in some kind of collusion that's all been disproved. How do you govern? I mean, you've been down there a long time. How do you govern in the midst of this madness when this was, but the president was tweeting long before he was on medication. Now he's medicated. God knows what we're going to get in the next 3.5 weeks. How do you govern, Congressman, in the middle of this?
Very, very difficult. It's very difficult for his own people who work for him. Secretary Mnuchin and Speaker Pelosi have been discussing trying to get an agreement on a follow-on stimulus package and help to people that need it and help to states and local governments and tribal governments that are hemorrhaging revenues that need help. Baltimore County, the city, Prince George's County, St. Mary's, Charles, Calvert, Anne Arundel that I represent, they need help. But you have an impulsive, erratic, irrational, and irresponsible leader of the greatest nation on earth. The good news about America is not that in a democracy we don't from time to time make mistakes. The good news is, in America in particular, we correct those mistakes. And we need a leader that is not any of those, that being erratic and impulsive and changing your mind. On the one hand, 3 days ago or 2 days ago, he said, 3 days ago, we're not going to negotiate. The day after, he says, oh, no, we'll negotiate on A, B, C, and D. Mnuchin, I think, wants a deal. I know Pelosi wants a deal. You're going to have the speaker on, as I understand, later today, maybe, or at some point in time.
Yeah, today.
And the fact of the matter is, they would have gotten an agreement, in my opinion, if you hadn't had the impulsiveness of Donald Trump and, frankly, McConnell's wanting to do only one thing. Doesn't care about getting people food, doesn't care about getting people additional dollars, doesn't care about the airlines. He wants to do put another justice on the Supreme Court, acting totally opposite of what he said 3 years ago when he said, when Obama nominated somebody with 10 months to go in his term, Merrick Garland, who was a moderate, a middle-of-the-road guy trying to appeal to both sides, and McConnell said, we're not going to consider him because we're in an election year. We're 20-some-odd days from an election, and they're going to have hearings and try to confirm a Supreme Court justice and not listen to the American people. And they claimed sanctimoniously the reason we're not considering President Obama's appointee is because we want to listen to the American people. And by the way, Don and Nestor, you recall the American people, more of them voted for Hillary Clinton than voted for Donald Trump.
3 million. So
they ignored the voice of the American people.
Three million people. Well, bring us up to date. I know your phone. I know you're on the phone constantly. I know that you're speaking with the speaker constantly. You're trying to make sense out of this madness. Where do we stand? It'll change by the time it goes up later today. But where do you think we stand now in getting the American people the additional help that they need? And from the way I understand it, and you'll correct us, Congressman, you'll correct us, the Democrats have already come down significantly. I mean, you've come off a number to try to get an agreement to try to move this thing forward on behalf of the American people. States are hurting. People are hurting. How do we move? Tell us where we are right now. You just got off the phone with the speaker. What do we do?
Well, the good news is, I want to repeat, I believe Secretary Mnuchin wants to get a deal. And the American people ought to remember the Speaker Pelosi from our state of Maryland and Secretary Mnuchin did four deals. We passed four bills trying to stimulate the economy and meet the health needs of the American people. Those bills were passed through the Congress overwhelmingly on big bipartisan votes, Don. So the good news is the secretary and the speaker are talking this afternoon, and I'll talk to her later on this evening, maybe after, you know, you talk to her. But that's the good news. The bad news is, I don't think McConnell wants to do a deal. As you recall, when we passed our bill, he said, I'll let the states go bankrupt. Frankly, if the states go bankrupt, they're going to lay off an additional million of people around the country. Terrible for the economy. And they hire the teachers, they hire the police, they hire the firefighters, they fire the sanitation workers, they fire others who are critically important in our everyday lives, keeping our communities functioning. You know that as a former county executive of Baltimore County. Yeah, you hired most of the people that interface in the daily lives. We may at the federal level, you know, think we're big deals, but you know that it's the local governments that really affect the people on a daily basis.
Our trash isn't getting picked up the right way in the city, right? Like right now, a COVID, exactly. we you know, that's a very, very basic issue just walking through the city that it doesn't take 5 minutes to figure out whether you're picking your trash up or not.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and going back, you are right, Don. We had a $3.4 trillion bill. Now, I want to, that figure is incomprehensible. It's just such a large figure. But we're trying to prop up and keep running the largest economy in the world. Chairman Powell of the Federal Reserve in a speech yesterday said, we need to do that kind of money, or we risk recession, or worse, depression, with additional millions of people unemployed. So, We understand we're only in charge of the House. So they charge the Senate and they have the presidency. So we reduced, you're absolutely right, by $1.2 trillion, 35%. We came down 35% of a bill that we passed through the House. So it wasn't just an idea. it was a bill that passed the House. So we came down 35%. And unfortunately, shortly thereafter, the president said, we're going to stop negotiations. Now, I think he got a lot of flack for that. And I think the stock market fell precipitously. And I'm sure his advisor said, you know, we've got to have a deal here. And so we're back at the table. I'm hopeful that it will have bear fruit. I'm hopeful that I will have to call back. And I've told the members I'm going to call them back with 24 hours notice. If we have a deal, as soon as we have a deal, I'm going to call the members back and we're going to pass it. Because, Don, as you pointed out, and Nestor, you know, the American people are hurting. The unemployed are hurting. Families are hurting. People are in food lines. They're hurting. They're having medical problems, obviously, not only with the virus, but with other medical problems. The fact is, we have to act. We got to keep the airlines going. That's a national security issue, and it's also an economic issue for the country. And so many other areas where we need to act, which are included in this bill, that, as I said, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who's not a partisan official, says we need to do this. And hopefully we will have some success over the next few days, because we need to get a deal to help the American people.
Well, Congressman, that's a great summary. Now, you've been down there long time, decades. You've been down there decades. You've worked in Congresses that were easier to work in others. Can you, for our listeners, give us a glimpse of what is happening now? And what I mean by that is, you've known a lot of these Republican members on the other side of the aisle for years. You represent a district that's quite diverse politically. I mean, it's not just one big liberal bastion, the district that you represent down through Southern Maryland. I know that district well.
Right.
What privately, what do your friends on the other side of the aisle express to you about their frustration with the leadership and what I'll call the Trump presidency, and where they know they actually need to be, but they don't appear to be able to get there, if that makes any sense?
Well, Don, when I first came to the Congress, it was 1981. Ronald Reagan had been just elected. He was president of the United States. And they had a very vigorous agenda that was a Republican-oriented agenda for the first year of his term. After that, however, it sort of settled down. And while we had disagreements, as I said, Ronald Reagan was a common sense guy who loved his country and wanted the government to work. He was critical of the government, but he wanted it to work. And although I was not in the leadership at that point in time, you know, I was brand new. I was not certainly going down to White House meetings as I do now, although I haven't been lately.
Why is that? Oh, I'm sorry.
Right. I haven't been there lately. I was invited down the other day and I didn't go, but
you're safer.
You're right. That was good news. I didn't go. The Congress was working with Reagan. George H.W. Bush was a prince to work with, a man of great integrity, of character, honesty. You know, he was a very good person, and we could work with him. Again, we had political differences, Don, but it wasn't a question of hostility or confrontation all the time. I was the sponsor of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is one of my proudest achievements, and George H.W. Bush signed that bill, and I worked very closely with him and the White House staff in getting that bill passed. The Clinton administration, obviously, from our standpoint, was a good administration. We got a lot done. And as I say, it was one of the most successful economic times that this country has experienced in Nestor, in your lifetime. And frankly, in my lifetime, although I was born in the beginning of World War II.
The 90s were a pretty good decade. I agree with that. I'll sign on for that.
The 90s were a good decade. And then, you know, we had George W. Bush. George W. Bush is a good friend of mine. He's a delightful human being. I disagree with him on policies, but I remember, Don and Nestor, one time we were sitting around the cabinet table He leaned over and looked down. I was four seats. I guess you had Nancy, who was the speaker, Boehner, who was the minority leader, and then myself, and I was the majority leader. And he leaned over to me and said, Hoyer, said, I don't know anybody that I like more who disagrees, votes against me more than you. And everybody laughed, of course, and I laughed. But I call him on his birthday. His birthday's in July. I call him. So we had a good, positive relationship, even though we had political differences.
What did you have in common? Because I would say in any marriage of people or minds, I mean, my wife and I don't agree on everything. We try to get together on the things we do agree on, right? So, like, I think when you find commonality, you find rapport. When you find rapport, you find respect. You find something you can meet in the middle. It's a ball game or a beer, right?
First of all, what we had in common, he loved his country more than himself. He was not the total focus of his focus. He loved the country, and we shared those values. We share much more in common as Americans in terms of our basic values than we have differences. But the differences become much, much starker than they used to be. So, and we shared a view that we wanted the government to work.
And Congressman, you were there. I'm going to interrupt you just for 1 second, okay. And I apologize. That's a terrible terrible trait that we have here. But I'm thinking about it because you were there. One of the examples that's often used is that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan had this sort of slogan, and you were there. You were part of it, that after 6 o'clock, we're all friends, and that they could go out and socialize. Is that folklore? Or is that truly the way it was under Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan?
You know, I think it was more true, Don, actually, of Bob Michael, who was the Republican leader of the House of Representatives. Bob Michael from Peoria, Illinois, who was the Republican leader when I went to the Congress, and for the next 13 years was the Republican leader. And sadly, he was pushed out by Newt Gingrich, and I'll get to that in a second. But Tip and Bob Michael were good friends. Bob Michael, I was a lot younger than Bob, but he and I became very, very dear friends. He was a man of great character, great civility, good humor. He was a wonderful, wonderful human being, conservative Republican from Peoria, Illinois, the middle of our country, but he cared about his country. And yes, you go back and forth on the floor. 5 o'clock came. Unfortunately, 5 o'clock comes and we're still in session a lot of times, but would come. And he and Tip were good friends, and they respected one another, and they worked together on that on which they agreed, and they disagreed without getting disagreeable with one another. Then Newt Gingrich came. Newt Gingrich's premise was, as long as we work together to make this institution work, Democrats will continue to get reelected. And it wasn't a bad premise. He said, you've got to make the institution look bad. You've got to make the Democrats look bad. You've got to have confrontation and crisis and chaos, because that's what will lead to people turning to the Republican Party. And he pursued that for 14 years, and it happened in 1994. And Gingrich became the leader of the House, and he was a confrontational leader. And he recruited people to run who wanted to be confrontational and who had not respect for other people in the House of Representatives on the other side of the aisle, but contempt. And unfortunately, we've had trouble getting back to a place where, when I went there, I served on the Appropriations Committee. We all worked together. There were differences, but there were no angry differences. And I tell people, I served on the Appropriations Committee. There were 13 people, 8 Democrats. We were in charge, 5 Republicans. And I tell people, you could put us all together, throw us up in the air. We come down in random chairs, have a markup. You would not have known who the Republican or the Democrat was. They were all people working together to make our country work. So,
is that the only way it can work?
Pardon?
Is that the only way it can work, to literally get a bunch of you together that really do can and will and want? There needs to be a want to work together, right? There needs to be that needs to be the ideology, right?
Nestor, I think that's a very key point. You need to want to. Sometimes people ask me, when are you guys going to get together? And my response perhaps confounds them, because I respond, as soon as you do. And what I mean by that, if the American people elect angry people who want to confront and do not respect the other side, whether it's Democrats respecting Republicans or vice versa, then you're going to get a Congress that's angry and chaotic and confrontational. You know, you ought not to be surprised. Democracy works. If you elect angry people in the Congress, it's going to be an angry Congress. On the other hand, if you elect people who say, look, I want to work together, I want to compromise. You know, ironically, people say, well, do you want people to work together? Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you're a husband or you're a wife or you're a child or you're your employer, employee, you know, you got to give and take. But then you ask them, well, do you want them to compromise their principles? Absolutely not. So you've got this constituency that wants you to stick exactly to what you want. But knowing full well in their own families, they can't do that. You know, if the wife gets her way all the time, the husband gets pretty uptight. If the husband gets his way all the time, the wife gets uptight. Kids are the same way, and parents. So life is about working together and trying to reach compromise. When, you know, you get something and you get something, and the next day maybe it's the opposite way. I hope we can get back there, but we're only going to get back there with a president who wants to be the chief leader of common sense and willingness to compromise. And you don't have to give up your principles to compromise. You don't give up your principles. What you can compromise on is, do we spend $5 or $10? That's not an issue, a moral issue. It's a practical issue. Can we afford 10 as opposed to 5? Do we need 10? Or can we get by with 6 or 7? And that's the, you know, it's a simplistic example, but that's what I mean by working together and compromising.
Hey, Don, this is the time where I hold the ballot up and I wave and I remind everyone one more time, vote, vote, vote. Don, I know our time is short.
It is short, and I want to respect the congressman's time because he's a busy, busy man right now. But I want to ask real quick before we head out of here. I think the thing that concerns so many of us right now, Congressman, is this attack coming from the president on the sanctity of the vote. And I've never seen anything like it in my career throughout education and then in politics. I've never seen anyone attack the American system. A couple questions that I think you can take us out of here on. How worried are you about a transition of power? And then, I hate to say it, I get asked this all the time, and it no longer appears hypothetical. How worried are you that come November the 4th, if Joe Biden does indeed win what looks to be perhaps a fairly significant vote, that the president won't leave, and how we handle that as a nation? And I know there's a lot there to unpack.
Well, this election is a big deal. This election is about a lot of issues. It's about health care, a very, very important issue. The Republicans are in the Supreme Court trying to take the Affordable Care Act away, which is going to undermine so many things. So the stakes in this election are huge because the gulf between the two parties is so great at this point in time. And as you point out, the president has tried to undermine the confidence of the American people in the electoral process, which is tragic, not only for our own country, but for the perception of people around the world that we're becoming a banana republic that can't rely on its elections. But let me tell you what I do believe, Don. I believe that Joe Biden's going to win. I believe that Donald Trump, because his modus operandi in business and in politics has been to constantly attack, mostly in the courts, you know, and try to work people out. And he's going to claim, other than if it hadn't been fraud, he would have been elected. He says voting by mail is a fraud. Everybody on this podcast listening ought to know he votes by mail.
Right.
He minor detail. And he votes by mail. So it's absurd. And then, you know, he said that for the last 3.5 years. All the U.S. attorneys work for him. No fraud cases have been brought by Republican U.S. attorneys. So it's a fallacious argument that he makes. But unfortunately, I think some of his people are going to believe if he loses, somehow it was stolen. That's baloney. But let me tell you what the good news is, in my view. Neither the armed forces nor the Secret Service will ignore the law. He's not going to be able to order the generals to, you know, protect him and have a coup in effect when Joe Biden wins the election. I think I'm hopeful Joe Biden will win on election night. And what Trump is hoping is a lot of his people will go to the polls and Democrats will vote by mail. So their ballots may be counted 2 days, 3 days later, 4 days later. That's what he's counting on. And he's going to sow doubt. But I think this election, frankly, looks like it's going to be a pretty good victory for Joe Biden. And the bigger this victory is, the more people Nestor holds up that vote, the more
people all day, every day, Congressman.
Keep doing it, Nestor. Keep doing it, because the more people that vote, the better off our country is going to be, the more stability there will be, the more decisive the decision on November 3rd or the days thereafter that the absentee ballots are counted, the more decisive that is, the more stable our country will be. So I join Nestor and you, Don, urging everybody to cast their vote, have expressed their opinion. I know there's some people that think Trump has done some really good things, and they give him credit for growing the economy. If you look at that graph, they just ought to look at the graph. What's the economy done in the last 3.5 years? You're exactly right, Don. What it's done is continued on the path that Obama set it on. I want to close with this. I think this is the most important election in which I'm going to be involved. And I hope any of you are going to be involved, including you, Nestor, and you're a lot younger than I am. I hope it's the most important in the
sense. Not a lot.
In the sense that the differences between the two parties and the two candidates are so great. I would probably vote for anybody against Trump. I think Trump is a danger to our country. Having said that, I don't need to do that. I can vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris because I think they bring the kind of experience, the kind of intellect, the kind of common sense and responsibility that America needs. We need stability, and we need to reflect to the rest of the world that we are worthy of being the leader of the free world.
Nestor, this is what leadership looks like. I think that's a mic drop. How about you?
Absolutely. Congress, we really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for being such a great guest. We're not going to give Nancy Pelosi a hard time. She's not a great as guest as you were, okay? Because you're a really good guest. So you, when you get back on later, you tell her the bar's high. You know, you
I
set
got
the bar
you, Nestor.
High. Hey, appreciate
right.
you. Thank
Nestor,
you very
Nestor,
much.
Wait a minute, Nestor. Real quick before we let the congressman go. I know he's got to run. But did I see right in my notes that you and the speaker – actually worked at the same time for Senator Dan Brewster? Is that a truth?
That is absolutely true. In 1964, I was in law school. Nancy had just graduated, I think, from Trinity. I think she had graduated from Trinity. And not only did we work in the same office, we worked in essentially 10 feet from one another. Nancy was sitting at a table. You know, she was just out of college. She was a receptionist. I was working as a paid intern, but essentially intern. I was doing academies. I was opening mail. I was, you know, doing the things that interns do. And she and I, we didn't get to know one another well, but we started out together on Capitol Hill in 1964. And now she's the speaker and I'm the majority leader. Who could have written that story and believed it?
Amazing. Ted Venatoris, man. What'd you learn from Dan Brewster this many years later?
Let me tell you, Dan Brewster, in my view, was a wonderful, wonderful individual. You know, he's from Glendon, from Baltimore County, was in the House of Delegates representing Baltimore County, then the Congress. And I started to work for him as an intern, unpaid, just doing grunt work in 1962. He was elected in November of 62 and then sworn in 63. And I worked with him for the 3 years I was in law school. As we all know, Senator Brewster had a very, very bad alcoholic problem. He almost died. He was overseas. He almost died, went into a coma, came back, and he had an extraordinary last half of his life, and where he headed up the Alcohol Abuse Commission in our state. He met his wife, Judy, in AA. And what a wonderful rehabilitation he had. And after he was defeated as a senator, largely because of his alcoholism, you know. And but he taught me decency. Interesting enough, he was a very, very good and decent man, polite man, who had an illness, alcoholism. But in the latter part of his life, he was extraordinarily contributory to the welfare of our state and to a lot of our people, and just a delightful, good human being.
Glad we have you on the wall, Congressman. Really appreciate your visit with us and staying a little overtime with Don, who always keeps our guests overtime. So
it's my fault.
Well, you know, Cardin and Van Hollen will tell you the same thing. You know, they see you later. Thanks for joining us.
All right, Nestor. Thanks a lot.
Congressman Steny Hoyer joining us here. And that was just that was great stuff. That's what we're doing here at Baltimore Positive, merging formerly WNST and sports with Baltimore Positive all into one place. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.